From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. The Republican National Convention came to a close last night with presidential candidate John McCain accepting the party nomination.
With hard work, strong faith, and a little courage, great things are always within our reach. Fight with me. Fight with me. Fight for what's right for our country.
I spoke with Farai Chidea, our regular host, who was in St. Paul, Minnesota, who described the reaction to John McCain's speech.
There are different reactions. One of them is relief, because a lot of Republicans don't see Senator John McCain as a great speechmaker. He's someone who notably has a hard time with teleprompters. But in some ways, it worked to his advantage, because over the course of the night or the day before, the Republican Party completely changed the setup in the hall, built a long catwalk for him to come out on, and he was standing at a lectern as if he were at the pulpit in a church with actual pieces of paper. Nobody uses paper anymore. Everybody uses teleprompter. And he spoke about his military experience as well as giving a large section of the speech on policy issues like energy.
Now, one of the things that we played at the beginning of our segment to introduce you was a clip from his speech last night at near the end of the speech, where he really began to get the crowd aroused and asked them to stand up and fight with him. The crowd really seemed to be into it.
Yeah, the crowd in the hall was into it all week, even at times when the speakers were not very dynamic. And it ran the gamut from, you know, former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, who gave a real wind-em-up speech, to Meg Whitman, the former CEO of eBay, who caused a lot of people to go out and get sodas during her speech. But this was a moment where Senator John McCain, again not known as the best speechifier, took complete control of the crowd and wound people up into a frenzy. People were crying, people were clapping, and then you had confetti and balloons and all sorts of kids and grandkids coming out on the stage. So from the point of view of getting the base fired up, he certainly did that.
We have another clip of him where he talked about his Vietnam War record as a prisoner of war, as did everyone else who was on the program all week, it seemed. Here's that clip.
On an October morning in the Gulf of Tonkin, I prepared for my 23rd mission over North Vietnam. I hadn't any worry I wouldn't come back safe and sound. I thought I was tougher than anyone. I was pretty independent then, too. I liked to bend a few rules and pick a few fights for the fun of it. But I did it for my own pleasure, my own pride. I didn't think there was a cause that was more important than me.
So, Farai, that seemed to be effective as well, wasn't it? Did it resonate with the audience and put him in a perhaps different light?
Well, the people who are going to vote for Senator McCain are very proud of his service. And I think even most people who aren't going to vote for Senator McCain are very proud of his service. The question was he going to reference it at all? Because every speaker from Sarah Palin to Senator, Fred Thompson had already referenced his story. And yet you saw people still, people couldn't get enough of this at a time when America is engaged in a war. There was a lot of talk also of the surge and how Senator McCain favored the surge and Obama didn't. But one of the things I found interesting, and, you know, both political parties obviously have their things that they gloss over, is that Osama bin Laden was originally traced to the Taliban in Afghanistan. The war in Iraq, as we have learned over the past few years, really has nothing to do with the original hunt for Osama bin Laden and the hunt for al-Qaeda. So Iraq was the war of choice to talk about, but Afghanistan, a war where we're having quite a bit of difficulty on the ground, was rarely, if ever, mentioned. And so that's something that I would bring up when you talk about this refrain of military service and success. That was a glaring example of something that didn't exist. And what also didn't exist was President Bush. He was never given a moment in the sun in the speeches, because in a certain way, Senator John McCain was running against the Bush legacy. But since they're members of the same party, it's rather embarrassing.
Let me ask you about another element of the speech last night that seemed to be different to me, at least, and to others that I've read. in terms of Barack Obama, and in contrast to Sarah Palin the night before, Senator McCain seemed to be much softer in his references to Obama than she was.
Yes, he was absolutely softer. And in some ways, it's the president and vice president thing is always a, you know, I'm the rapper, you're the DJ situation. You want the vice president to not take too much of the spotlight, but they're also your attack dog. They can say things that you can't. And certainly from a political strategy point of view, it's a good idea for the vice president to frame the debate in sharper terms. And some people say that, you know, we have a whole bunch of debates coming up now, vice presidential debates and presidential debates. And one analyst of debate says that the only way that a vice president can win a debate is by battling the president or the presidential nominee. Therefore, Sarah Palin could win debates by attacking Barack Obama, because attacking Joe Biden is not really the point, and vice versa, Biden attacking McCain. So, you know, Sarah Palin's job is to go in, take her son's hockey stick, and smack people around.
How would you compare and contrast, Farai, what you heard and saw in Minneapolis versus what you heard and saw in Denver a week ago with the Democrats?
Well, this is not quite what you were leading to, but I want to tell a quick story, and it's all up on our blog, News and Views. I went to a party that was an Africa Relief Organization's party, and the only black people there were me, a black man who was serving food, and a black woman who was serving food. And I talked to the black man who was walking around with trays of food, and he had these pink ear protectors, you know, earplugs in his ear. And we struck up a nice conversation, and he said, wow, you really witnessed history in Denver. And then he pulled out the earplugs. He said, the only reason I have these in is because I don't want to talk to anybody. And if they try to talk to me, I'll just say, I can't hear you. And there's this real disconnect that happened in Minneapolis, St. Paul, between a, you know, somewhat diverse city and a convention that was over 90% white. I think that there was some bad blood that developed and some questions about how the Republican Party is proceeding with what it says is its mission to produce a more generous and open relationship with African Americans and Latinos. You heard very little discussion of immigration because it cuts both ways in the Republican Party, even among Latinos. So there were a lot of sore spots here.
Was there a sense of the historic nature of the ticket, including Sarah Palin on the Republican side? We know that there was on the Democratic side with Barack Obama as the African-American nominee, but was there that same sense with the GOP?
Absolutely. People were absolutely proud to be part of a party that was making history on this level. And I think for a lot of Republicans, it was a real surprise, whether they liked it or not initially. I think everyone came around to really liking Sarah Palin. It was quite a surprise to have a woman on the ticket, and quite a pleasant surprise, I think, for most of the women and most of the men who came to the convention.
Thanks, Farai. You and Roy Hurst, our producer, did great work. Get some rest.
Thanks, Tony.
That was NPR's Farai Today, speaking to us from St. Paul, Minnesota. The last of the convention confetti has fallen, and the general election season is now officially underway. How did the conventions compare, and which candidates, if any, came out on top? For more, we have a special convention wrap-up roundtable with two journalists who were on the scene in St. Paul, Minnesota. Kevin Merida is an associate editor at The Washington Post. Ron Claiborne is a national correspondent for ABC News. Ron, Kevin, nice to have you guys.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Kevin, let me come to you, number one. The Republican Party was slow to embrace Senator McCain. The speeches are over. The convention is over. Has he won over his Republican base?
Well, it really is quite a remarkable story, McCain and the Republican Party. I mean, there was a period where he was close to being a pariah in the party. I mean, and at one point there were overtures from Democrats for him to switch over. I mean, and here he is accepting the nomination. I think Republicans are just amazed at their good fortune and how close the polls are, given that you know, 80% plus of the American people say that the country's on the wrong track, and President Bush is has the lowest approval rating of any president in modern history. Given that, and the race is so close, I think that they're relieved and excited that they have an actual chance to win the presidency again. And so McCain is the representation of that chance.
Let me ask you, Ron, and to give me kind of a brief answer because a break is coming up. I was watching last night, and while I know that the party was supportive of him, there seemed to be moments when delegates were not connecting with him. Am I right about that?
You did get that sense on the floor, but I think a lot of that had to do with the fact, as Farai was saying earlier, John McCain is not a great speaker. He gave probably as good a speech as he's capable of giving, but in the middle there, early sections when he was going through what was essentially a reprise of his stump speech, I think he lost the audience. He got them back at the end with his story about his experiences in Vietnam, but he kind of disconnected with them about midway through.
That speech went a lot longer than I think some people had expected. It was almost an hour, wasn't it, Ron?
I think it was about 40, 45 minutes. That is a long, long speech. That's a tough length of time for anyone to speak. McCain, you know, again, that's not his forte, but he did as well, I think, as he can. And the audience was pretty enthused there at the end.
All right, Kevin, Ron, I'm going to ask you to just hold on. We're going to take a short break. We'll continue our discussion about the aftermath of the Republican National Convention right after this short break. Just ahead, we continue our conversation about the Republican National Convention, and Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick gets ready for jail as disgraced lobbyist Jack Abramoff's prison sentence is extended. A look at the headlines eclipsed this week by the Republican National Convention. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. We're back now with our convention reporters roundtable with Kevin Merida, an associate editor at The Washington Post, and Ron Claiborne, a national correspondent for ABC News. Let's get right back into it, guys. Let me come to you, Kevin, with this. The big storyline, one of the big storylines all week, of course, was Sarah Palin, the governor of Alaska, chosen to be the vice presidential running mate. Now, my question is, how did that storyline change from last weekend when we first were introduced to her to now after all the speeches and the digging by the press into her background?
Well, I think that there was a period where you felt like you were maybe in the Dan Quayle era. You know, you may remember when President Bush, the first President Bush, chose Dan Quayle, and coming out of New Orleans there were questions about National Guard record and lots of questions, and people thought that maybe Bush would have to drop him. I think there was a sense that was wondering whether that she would survive. I think after her speech, not only did she electrify the audience, and there was, I guess, some backlash to media inquiries, it seemed like it turned around and it looked more and more like a great selection for Republicans, and some relief. I mean, it's still she still has to go out in America and see how people test her publicly, and, you know, to withstand the kind of scrutiny that voters will give her, not to mention a national traveling press corps. But right now, I think that they're pleased with their nominee.
Well, would you say, Ron, that the whispering, and I believe that's probably the most accurate way to put this, the whispering about her from party faithful, whether or not the risk is high with her on the ticket, has that whispering quieted now?
I think with that speech, she is quieted within the party, those critics. The Republican Party seems energized and supportive, energized like they really haven't been by John McCain himself right now. Now, this is all dependent, of course, on no more revelations. If everything that's come out, which seemed a little odd or peculiar or even suspicious, if that's all there is, then the party is satisfied with this vice presidential pick. The question is, can she extend her appeal outside of that base? She's gone a long way and solidifying. We could say that that base, which was a lot of which was suspicious of McCain's conservative credentials, they're happy. They're happy with this selection. But will this change the essential dynamics of the overall race? I think most people at the end of the day, that day being November 5th, are going to be voting for the top of the ticket.
One of the questions that I have, Kevin, listening to both Sarah Palin and John McCain, is this. She came out attacking. He came out much softer. Is that the tack that you imagine both will continue to have as the campaign moves forward, her attacking McCain, taking the more statesmanlike role?
Well, I think it's a high-risk strategy. I mean, certainly it's an historic role for vice presidential candidates to be the aggressors and taking on their opponents. So she's performing a role that other vice presidential nominees have performed. But, you know, we don't know. We're in uncharted territory of how that is going to play. She's a woman. Whether it will seem her aggressiveness will seem shrill, well, she will then maybe expose herself to, getting attacked back. And I think right now she's put Democrats in kind of an awkward place of knowing how to run against her. I mean, some people are hoping that Hillary Clinton would step up for the Democrats and take her on. But, you know, you think about Joe Biden, who's kind of an elder statesman in the party. I mean, he doesn't want to come across as looking like he's beating up on a woman. There were a lot of sexism charges during the Democratic primary campaign. So I think there's still this kind of sorting out across party lines of how each candidate is gonna run.
One of the things that the Democrats seem to have really glommed onto, Ron Claiborne, is this issue of community organizing and whether it's of value or being devalued by the Republicans. Rudy Giuliani made reference to it. Certainly Sarah Palin poked fun at it. And the Democrats under Obama seem to be jumping on that really hard, really quickly.
Well, I was in the arena when that first came up, when Giuliani brought it up, and then Palin hammered it home. It's almost like this is some kind of, well, a code word for something. At the very least, it's a code word for a quaint and meaningless liberal exercise. At the worst, it may have some other implications that I won't try to interpret at this point. But they seem to get a real kick out of that, and the Democrats are firing back, saying, as you would expect them, well, what in the world is wrong with community organizing? Community organizing, in the sense that Barack Obama did, it means trying to help people who in many cases could not help themselves. But I think for the Republican base, for conservatives, it's something that they gleefully scoff at. I don't know if this is going to have a lot of credence with the independents and moderates who John McCain and Barack Obama need to win this election.
One of the issues, Kevin, was whether or not with Sarah Palin and with the message of the GOP that they could reach into the Clinton supporters and pull them to their side. Based on what you saw, what you heard, people you've spoken to, what sense do you have about how effective the GOP will be at doing just that?
Well, that was the high risk in picking Palin in the first place. I mean, she's not traditionally, by vice presidential nominee standards, very experienced at all, having been a small town mayor. I know that I'll get criticism now from all of the people attacking the media elite. But here's the thing on that, you know, at the time when, she was a small town mayor, Barack Obama was a state senator in a district that was, 27 times the size of Wasilla, Alaska. He was a community organizer when he was 24 years old for 3 years. I think they're taking hoping that she will be able to cut into, independents and suburban women. She's going to go to a lot of places and battleground states where there's a toss-up. There's certainly a lot of disaffected Hillary Clinton Democrats. But I think that you saw at the Democratic convention that is not such a great percentage. The issues are still, there's a big gulf between where most women are on issues, whether they're reproductive rights and other concerns, and the Republican Party has positions in its platform and positions that both Sarah Palin and John McCain support that are really at odds with where a lot of women are.
You know, one of the things that occurred last night we should talk about briefly, Ron, and that is the protest. There was some disruption inside the convention hall. There were people gathered out on the streets. There have been some stories about the protests, but hard to gauge how significant they were and how much of a factor they were, at least as a person watching it on television.
Well, there were certainly some sparks flying outside of the convention hall there, and there was that brief protest early on in McCain's speech. We're hearing reports of hundreds of people being arrested outside, and if you look at some of the video, there were miniature recreations on a smaller scale, of course, of the kind of thing that was happening in Chicago, the Democratic Convention, 40 years ago. Some pretty ugly altercations there.
What was your take on what you saw as far as protesters were concerned? Did you even talk to any of them, Kevin?
I could not get close enough to them, but they were asserting, and certainly you could see there was some rather aggressive policing, you know, particularly with the use of tear gas on people, rather extensively and aggressively. I guess the determination was made that they were going to subdue these protests and keep them suppressed, but there was again some pretty aggressive police tactics used out there.
I've got a little less than a minute, Ron Claiborne. I'm going to give the last question to you, and it's this. What do we look forward to now between now and November, coming from either campaign in terms of trying to get their message across?
Well, you know, I think we've seen the pattern has been set that McCain is going to try to brand Barack Obama as someone who is out of touch, does not have leadership skills. Barack Obama is going to try to pin on John McCain that his administration would be a third Bush term. We've seen that. I think this is where this election may end up turning. There's really only a few events in the course of this long campaign which can really drive voters one way or the other. With the convention, those are over. Selection of the vice presidential running mate, that's over. I think the debates, the three presidential debates, and there'll be a lot of attention this year on the vice presidential debate on October 2nd. That could determine how this election goes, who is perceived as the winner of those series of debates.
Kevin, Ron, thank you guys both very much.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you.
That was Kevin Merida, an associate editor at the Washington Post, and ABC correspondent Ron Claiborne. As you no doubt know, most of our focus this week was on the Republican National Convention. Now, though, we turn to some news events overshadowed by the top political news. Detroit starts to pick up the pieces after the city's mayor pleads guilty to obstruction of justice and agrees to resign. Convicted lobbyist Jack Abramoff gets 4 more years in prison for corruption. And for more on those stories and more from that, we have Jerome Vaughn, news director for Detroit's WDET, and Adrian Walker, a reporter for the Boston Globe. Adrian, Jerome, nice to have you on News and Notes.
Good to be here.
Jerome,
glad to be here.
Jerome, I'm coming back to you because we talked, I guess it was yesterday, my memory serves me, about Kwame Kilpatrick agreeing to resign after pleading guilty to obstruction of justice. How is the city coping today? What's next?
Well, you're right. It was yesterday, and everyone here is just taking a deep breath, you know, really trying to take it all in, soak it all up. The mayor, who had been under political pressure to resign for months and months and months, finally took a plea bargain agreement, pleaded guilty to a couple of felonies, and, you know, will have to pay $1 million restitution, will have to spend 4 months in jail, will have to give up his pension. And people are just really taking it all in. We've been stunned repeatedly over the past several months, and yesterday was a great opportunity for him to wind this all up and for the rest of the city to be able to start thinking about moving on from here.
Adrian, you know, it's no secret that News and Notes is a program at NPR that is designed with the interest of an African-American audience to heart. But my question is, with regard to Kwame, looking on the internet and seeing how that story is covered in the rest of the country, the kind of play that it's been receiving has been uneven, perhaps would be the fairest way to say it. What's the coverage been like, if at all, in Boston?
It has received very little attention in Boston, and I've been a little surprised, not just here, but looking around nationally at how little attention it's gotten. It's really a sad story when you think about what's happened, and you think about, you know, all the promise when Mayor Kilpatrick went into office and what it's all come down to.
Do you think, Jerome, that Kilpatrick will eventually get back into politics? I know it's a little early maybe to know that.
Well, it looks like he is already thinking about that. You know, as the day was progressing yesterday, we got word late afternoon that the mayor was going to make a special address. Right about 7:30 he did, and it sounded more like a campaign speech than a goodbye speech. I mean, it was amazing how he talked about all the things his campaign had accomplished, all the reasons that the other politicians were against him, and that's why he was in the position that he was in. And, you know, at the end, he really said, you know, you set me up, Detroit, for a comeback. So he's already looking down the road. Now, as part of the plea bargain agreement, he can't run for office for 5 years, but come 2013, 2014, we'll likely see his name on the ballot.
One more story about Detroit before we move on to some other topics. It's this: Council President Kenneth Cockrell Jr. taking over the mayoral post on September the 19th. Back to you, Adrian. Jerome, who is he? Tell us a little bit about him and the kind of mayor you might expect him to be.
He is a smart, intelligent, fairly mild-mannered sort of guy, really has a good grasp of the politics in a good way of what's going on in Detroit. He was elected a few years back as the president of city council, and you become president of city council by getting the most votes to be placed on city council. That's how we choose our president. So he was very popular. Over the years, there's been quite a bit of battling between Mayor Kilpatrick and the city council, but those sorts of battles go back decades in the city of Detroit. He's going to come in. He's going to look at what needs to be done and get to work. He understands he's going to be an interim acting mayor, but all expectations are that next year, whether we have a special election or he's interim mayor until the general election in November, he will be running for mayor. And he's going to look to, you know, boost the police presence. Crime is rising in Detroit. He's going to look to shore up the city's finances. You know, we're on the edge of having to lay off several hundred workers. You know, there's a lot to be done, and a lot has built up in the past few months, as the city's been a little more paralyzed in the midst of this Kilpatrick crisis.
All right, let's move on to topic number two. Jack Abramoff, the former lobbyist, pleading guilty to charges of fraud, tax evasion, and conspiracy to bribe public officials, having his sentence extended. I'm imagining, Adrian, that is a story being covered in
Boston. Oh, absolutely. Sure. You know, any story of a corrupt lobbyist is always a good story, especially on the East Coast.
What do you think this means for him, for Abramoff? The obviously, is that it's continuing his time behind bars. But what does it mean for him in a larger sense and the impact that that's having on lobbying in general?
Well, in Abramoff's case, I think you have to assume that his career as a lobbyist was probably over anyway as a result of the original sentence. And I don't really know what effect it will have on lobbying on K Street. I would guess not a very dramatic effect. I think, in a way, it's sort of an isolated incident.
All right, well, hold.
But time will tell.
I tell you what, we're going to continue this conversation. We're going to talk more about Abramoff. We're going to talk about some of the problems facing U.S. Representative Charles Rangel, who was in hot water over reports that he failed to report $75,000 in money that he earned. And then we're going to talk about Oprah Winfrey and whether or not she should have Alaska Governor Sarah Palin on her show. Some say she should. She apparently is saying that she is not going to. So we're going to talk about all of that when we come back right after this quick break. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. We're back with more of our Reporters Roundtable. We're joined by Jerome Vaughn, News Director, Program Director for Detroit's WDET, and Adrian Walker, a reporter for the Boston Globe. We were going to talk about Charlie Rangel as we were leaving, and he apparently, the congressman from New York, in trouble, perhaps, after reports surfaced that he failed to report $75,000 in earned money from property in the Dominican Republic. Jerome, can you fill us in more about what exactly is going on here?
Yeah, he got no mortgage interest on a beach resort that he bought many, many years ago outside of the country, and hadn't paid any taxes on it. And it's especially embarrassing for him because, you know, he's on the Ways and Means Committee. So he's one of the people who is, in charge of the U.S. tax code. And for him to say he didn't know he had to pay on this is really very embarrassing for him. One other thing I'll say is, you know, we started off this segment talking about Mayor Kilpatrick and then Jack Abramoff and now Charlie Rangel. I mean, we're really talking about reasons here that the presidential election is focused on change this year. You've got all of these politicians and lobbyists who are accused of wrongdoing. It really adds up very quickly.
You know, that's a very salient point that you make, Jerome. It comes, of course, on the heels of a report that the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee also has rent-controlled property in New York. Now, today, let me just say this, Adrian. Today, we spoke with Rangel's attorney, Lanny Davis, from the firm Orrick & Herrington. And he told us that Rangel was not aware of the money he owed because of a lack of communication from the resort in the Dominican Republic. He also said that Rangel is not likely to owe the federal government. Okay, Adrian.
Well, you know, with all due respect to Lanny Davis, I don't know. I mean, maybe he doesn't owe federal taxes, but that doesn't change the fact that this is awfully embarrassing. You know, it's a big omission, and $75,000 in income is sort of a lot to forget, particularly coming on the heels of the rent control story in which, you know, the Times reported a couple months ago that he has four rent control departments in Harlem. It's a lot of bad news for Rangel. I don't think it will put him in any kind of electoral jeopardy. In fact, I'm pretty sure it won't, because he's such a legend in Harlem. I mean, it's almost inconceivable that he would have a close race, but this is not good.
Here's another story that has, well, we won't put a judgment on it. We'll just talk about it. It involves Oprah Winfrey, who says that she doesn't want any political candidates on her show until after the election. Now, this comes after it was revealed that her team is divided about having Sarah Palin on the show. Her audience has made requests online to have the Alaska governor on the air, and she issued a statement saying that she is not going to use her show for political purposes and that they would consider having Sarah Palin on after the election. What's your first, at first blush, Jerome, what do you think of this?
Well, you know, I would never presume to doubt Oprah's wisdom. That's a sure way to get in trouble. But, you know, if it were me, I would have her on. I mean, we all know that she supports Obama and supports him greatly. She doesn't have the same sort of requirements of balance as a news show or, might have. And it's going to build some ratings. I mean, so in that respect, I would think, you know, go for it. Everyone knows it's not your candidate, but, you know, you'd get a good show out of it. So that's what I think about it.
Well, Adrian, you know, she is not a journalist. We all know that. And she's not required to give equal time to each side of the political spectrum. And we could also point to Jay Leno, for example, as having had Republican candidates on and not necessarily balancing that with the Democrats. But what's your take on how this should play out?
Well, I mean, it's Oprah's house. I think she can have whoever she wants on her show, but I agree with Jerome. It would be great television to have her on. And, you know, Oprah's kind of got to decide whether she wants to be in the selection or not. If she's going to, you know, be part of it, then she may as well have, then she should have Republicans on. We all know that she supports Obama. I don't really see what the big harm is in having Palin on for an hour. And it's kind of disingenuous to say, well, I'll be happy to have her on after the election. Nobody's going to care after the election, as she well knows.
Now, that's true. Now, she's had Barack Obama on her show on two occasions, but both of those occasions were before he announced his candidacy for the presidency. I'm not suggesting that that makes a real difference, but it is a difference, isn't it?
It's a kind of a technical difference. And so he was pretty clearly running when he was on, if I remember correctly.
Now, would you think, Jerome, that were she to put Sarah Palin on her show, that obviously there would be a ratings bonanza for her for the show, but she would risk losing or alienating a sizable chunk of the Oprah audience base, wouldn't she, if she went after her because of her support of Obama?
I don't think she would lose anybody. I mean, people tune into Oprah because they love what she does from day to day, and they love her personality. And I think they would respect her for, you know, everyone knows that she supports Obama, that she have the, you know, the courage or whatever to have on somebody who didn't agree with her. I think that would, you know, endear her even more to a lot of people. And it's one show. I mean, it's not like it's going to be the Oprah and Sarah show for a week. It's just going to be an appearance.
Really briefly, I don't know whether you guys watch Oprah Winfrey or not, but if Sarah Palin were to be on the show, would you both watch?
Yes, absolutely. Just out of curiosity.
And sure. I'm right with you there.
And you know what? I would watch it with you as well. Fellas, thank you very much for coming on Reporters Roundtable. We appreciate the conversation.
My pleasure.
My pleasure, too.
Adrian Walker is a reporter for the Boston Globe, and Jerome Vaughn is news program director for member station WDET in Detroit. He spoke with us from the studios there. Presidential candidates look to red states and blue states for their voting base, but it's the so-called purple states or swing states that can decide the election. Last week, we spoke to Democratic delegates from some of those states that are still up for grabs. We talked about the issues they thought would swing voters in their states. Today, we have that same discussion with three Republican delegates, Linda Lee Tarver from Michigan, Dan Williams from Minnesota, and Jim Brady from Ohio. Welcome to News and Notes.
Thank you.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.
Linda, let me come to you first. What's your impression so far of what you have seen, and what are the people in your state saying about it?
I have spoken to the delegates from Michigan here. We are revved up and excited about Sarah Palin. We are definitely excited and behind John McCain.
Now, recent polls are showing that while Ohio is still in play, that Minnesota and maybe Michigan are beginning to turn a little bit blue. But Ohio, Jim Brady, seems to be one of the keys. What are you sensing and hearing and feeling?
Actually, what we're sensing in Ohio is, again, that it's going to come down to Ohio as it's done in the last two elections. Ohio is a relatively purple state. We've been pretty red in the past, but due to some economic factors, I think folks are looking for change, as Senator Obama is talking about. And I guess the one caveat with that is sometimes promises aren't always as easily fulfilled as they sound.
Dan, Minnesota has voted for the Democratic candidate in the last two presidential elections, and your governor, Tim Pawlenty, was reportedly on Senator McCain's short list for Veep, and Republicans did choose your state to host their convention. And I mentioned just a moment ago that recent polls, and understanding that they are just polls, suggest that Minnesota may be turning blue again. What do you think it would take to turn Minnesota red?
Absolutely. Minnesota is in play, and certainly we have a great governor. He has a two-decade-plus history with Senator McCain, and being on that short list, that brought attention to Minnesota and with the convention being here. What will it take? I think people seeing the party as a whole being showcased here in Minnesota, and with the speeches, we had a situation where if you look at the bases being loaded in the bottom of the ninth, down by one, and our VP candidate came up and hit a grand slam. And so with that grand slam, people heard the opportunity for a governor with executive experience to come in and leverage that experience on behalf of the McCain administration and say, here's how governors around the country can work with the McCain administration to reduce frivolous spending, to be responsible and accountable. And these type things really hit at the heart of people that expect something of their legislators. Also, with her history and certainly Senator McCain's history at the legislature and as military, that hits at the heart of the working people that are saying, okay, what's going to happen with my family? How do I work with my family? How do I work within my community? And so that causes people to say, okay, now we are moving beyond just rhetoric of change. We're looking at positive change, real change, and that's going to move Minnesota into our column.
Let me bring Linda Lee Tarver into the conversation, because I want to ask you, I'll ask all three of you, but I'll begin with you, Linda. It's this. The war, the economy, social values. Of those three, put them in priority order for the people of your state in terms of which way they are likely to vote in November?
It's the economy, stupid. That's what the mantra is in Michigan. We have the highest unemployment rate in the nation, and we didn't have Hurricane Katrina to attribute to that. We also have a exodus of our manufacturing. Our GM and our car industry is going away in Michigan, and we have a Democratic governor and a Democratic-controlled House. And our major city, which is controlled by Democrats, the mayor of our largest city and our jewel, pled guilty to two felonies. And so in terms of Michigan and change, I believe there will be a change. I believe John McCain can win and will win Michigan as a result of the leadership that we've seen in the Democratic Party.
Now, Jim, let me ask Jim Brady, because, Jim, you're a councilman from Shaker Heights, if I understand that correctly, right?
Yes, sir.
All right. So economy has been an issue for Americans across the board in some senses, but there are other issues that seem to be of interest, particularly with regard to the Republican social values being one of them. From your state's standpoint, which of those three issues is the key?
From the state's perspective, I think obviously the economy is the most important thing. Ohio, very similar to Michigan in demographics, but Ohio is kind of split. You know, you've got the Northeast where it's primarily manufacturer base, where you've got automobile plants, you got, you know, Lordstown and GM. The further south you go, it's more rural. What I've found is, you know, the folks up north, primarily Democratic, under Democratic rule for the last, you know, for as long as I can remember. I have to echo Linda's sentiment in that the African-American community up in Northeast Ohio, I think that they're ready for change too, because they've been under Democratic leadership. And in Cleveland, we've got county commissioners who are being indicted by federal agents, and there's just a lot of corruptness in this party. And I'm not just saying it's from a Democratic perspective, but it is what it is. And so I think that addressing the economy is obviously the most important thing. But me personally, I'm more of a hawk. I'm a former Army officer. I'm involved in the I'm involved with my company directly with the global war on terror. And I also think that a McCain administration is going to keep us safe.
Now, let me bring to you, Dan, this point. It was made last night by Mayor Giuliani, who said that there's change and then there is change. And some change is good and some change we don't want. Following up with what Jim Brady just talked about, needing change, certainly from an economics point of view in his state, as well as what Linda said in Michigan, what kind of change do the people from Minnesota want? Do they just want change inside the Beltway, or do they want change for America?
Well, Minnesota participates not only nationally but globally. You've got 3M here. This was the headquarters for Honeywell. You've got a number of CEOs out of Minnesota, and you've got a number of people migrating here from other states. I was raised in Detroit. Actually, I remember living through the riots in 67 in Detroit, and that was the next year, 68, the reason I became a Republican. So in Minnesota, we're looking at, and I think it's the same as the country, we're looking at an economic change that will meet the day-to-day for both the small business owners, those that are underemployed, that they know that they can both buy the gas, buy the groceries, buy the medicine, and also for the small business owners, that they are able to hold the payroll that they have and looking at revenue-generating opportunities to expand their business, and also that there's a responsible relationship with the state and the federal government for large business that they can continue to expand and to compete globally. So the good change would be that we build an infrastructure where you look at the economy, if you look at the numbers over the last 8 years, we have been doing well. We have lost some jobs, and there have been some circumstances and situations that hit individual homes. So the change that we're looking at with the McCain administration is have a good balance that the federal government performs the way it should, stop wasteful spending, let that money come back to the small business owners, come back to those that have paid the taxes, and have good corporate citizens from the large business. So that is a change.
Let me stop you there, only because our time is running really short. I want to get one more question in, and I'd like all of you to get an opportunity to respond to it. So be as brief as you can. And the question is this. This is an historic election, whether you are a Republican or a Democrat. How much of a factor is that, do you think, in the race, the historic nature of voting either for the first woman as VP or the first African-American as president? Linda.
Personally, I'm not voting for history. We've done that. I've done that in Michigan. I voted for the first term of our governor for historic purposes, the Democrat, and I regret it to this day. So in terms of my own personal historic vote, I'm not voting for Barack Obama because he is black, and nor am I voting for McCain because he has a woman on the ticket.
All right, let me ask Dan, because we've got our time is really short,
sure.
Unfortunately. Dan, what's your
same reason? Content of character and ability to lead. We will make history either way, but you never vote for color,
Jim Brady,
or gender.
Yeah, just real quick, it's obviously a historic moment. I'd be lying if I didn't say that I was excited to see an African-American being nominated. But again, I don't vote with my emotions. I vote with my values and with my ideology, and that's why I'm voting for McCain. Yes.
I appreciate all three of you. Thank you so much. Linda Lee Tarver from Michigan, Shaker Heights Councilman Jim Brady, a Republican delegate from Ohio, and Dan Williams, a Republican delegate from Minnesota. They all joined me from the NPR special studios at the RNC convention in St. Paul, Minnesota. That's News and Notes. Nicole Childers and Christabel and Sia Boadi produced the show. Sasha Woodruff edits. Kenya Young is the director. Shireen Strausberg is our technical engineer. Marcia Caldwell, the drive engineer. The staff includes Faraj Dea, Roy Hurst, Jeffrey Bennett, Jeffrey Gardner, Devin Robbins, Anthea Raymond, Drew Tewksbury, and Joanne Griffith. To listen to the show or subscribe to the podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for the newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Next week, the political conventions have wrapped up, but what was the reaction abroad? We'll talk to reporters in different corners of the globe. I'm Tony Cox. Faraj Chidea will be back on Monday. This is News and Notes.